Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is September 27th, 2017. Now, in our framework at Peak Prosperity, you know there are eight forms of capital. And if you are at least partially fulfilled in those eight forms, you will be far happier and far more resilient than someone who has only a lot of money. Further, you've heard me say that of the eight forms, that the most important of them all is your emotional capital. If you lack emotional resilience, you can have all the money in the world. You could have a fantastic homestead and deep skills, but if you fall to pieces anyways at the first sign of trouble, then those won't amount to very much. Further, in a longer emergency, such as what is being faced in Puerto Rico right now as a consequence of Hurricane Maria, social capital, the deep bonds of trusted knowing that can exist within and among a group of people, are essential. Both emotional and social capital require maturity and having a rich tool set at your disposal to navigate the tricky world of interrelating. Now, said simply, your emotional capital is a function of your relationship to yourself, and your social capital is your ability to meet other people where they are and truly help to enrich their lives with your presence. So it's the inner world and the outer world. Where these come together most intimately for most people is in their primary love relationship. Now, to help us explore this area is a practitioner of the Gottman Method. He'll explain what this is in a moment. With us today is Michael Basta. He's a licensed clinical social worker with 30 years experience helping emotionally distressed couples and families to improve their relationships and to develop more effective interpersonal skills. Basta began training as a Gottman Method couples therapist in 2002, and this method has become the central focus of his practice. Welcome, Michael. I'm so happy to have you with us today.
Great to be here, Chris.
Well, before we get to the Gottman Method, Michael, what would you describe as emotional resilience? What does that look like to you?
Emotional resilience. Well, I would say having that ability to adapt to one's circumstances and individually, but my framework as a couples therapist is that I see things in this kind of systemic web. So it's hard. So I guess what I would say is that how one then relates. I think what you're calling you're talking about social capital. How one relates to others in their environment, especially those closest to them, their intimate partner in particular. Is intimately caught up in that.
Yeah, and we look at emotional resilience as the ability to adapt, as you mentioned, and to meet the changing times. So circumstances change. How do you adapt? How do you move? How do you change with those experiences? I would be interested in also in your experience. Part of what we look at Peak Prosperity from the outside in is that there's some ecological stressors going on. There's certainly economic stressors going on. There's some very big picture things going on that when people pop their heads up and look at them, that can create an emotional reaction more than an intellectual reaction. And that emotional reaction is sometimes like, they have that tightening sense. And that certainly seems to have come to the fore, and I don't really want to discuss that with you today, but that's the backdrop, is that given these large stressors that are happening out there, they're really in many ways reflecting a breakdown in our relationship as a species to the ecological world, our disconnection from nature. And if we break that all the way back down to where you work and where I think all the transformation in this story happens, it's how are we relating to ourselves and to those most intimately with us? Because I don't think it's possible to have a great relationship with the big picture if you have a poor one with a small picture. So
absolutely.
Great. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I would add a couple of things. My read, first of all, in terms of the resiliency literature, is that one of the key factors always, and especially if you look at kids and how kids can come from, you know, quite difficult, deprived backgrounds and still come out doing quite well in the world, one of the primary factors is always around relationship. Hmm. So it would be having a strong mentor in one's life. And when we look at factors that would predict longevity in life, in the reading that I've done, it looks like even more than genetics, having a strong intimate partner in one's life that's reliable and trustworthy in a person's life comes out as a number one factor. So I would say a relationship is intimately tied in with resiliency in the way I look at it.
Yeah, that's a great point you bring up. And there's been some very troubling articles of late, one in The Atlantic recently, which talked, I think the title of it, if I'm going to paraphrase, is Have Smartphones Killed a Generation or Destroyed a Generation? Yeah. And the idea being that the relationships that are happening now are through the thumbs across texting and through Snapchatting and very two-dimensional, very fast, but not direct face-to-face interpersonal, which is a much trickier landscape to navigate in terms of subtlety and developing actual bonds that seem to provide us with that meaning and purpose that you say can lead to things that we can measure, like longevity and happiness.
Exactly. I don't know I haven't read the Atlantic article, but I've recently heard a research psychologist from, I think it was San Diego State, talking about the tracking of mental health measures, and was specifically looking at teen depression. And what she noted was that there was a doubling of the incidence of teen depression starting in 2012. And when they reduced down all the factors that may have been involved, what they were really looking at was exposure to screen time. Not the content of the screen time, but just the fact that kids are growing up with so much exposure to screens.
Well, let's turn now to this idea of relationship then, because the screen time obviously is one form of entertainment and is a relationship with a device, but it's not a human relationship.
And exactly.
So let's talk now about the Gottman method. What is first? What is it? And when and why was it developed?
Well, Gottman method is a method of couples therapy. And it stems from the research of Dr. John Gottman and one of his main collaborators was Dr. Robert Levinson. The two of them collaborated way back in the beginning in the early 70s at the University of Indiana. And later, Levinson went on to UC Berkeley, and Gottman went on to University of Washington. But what they did, and I think what they would say if you interviewed them, is that they had a series of failed relationships, and they were very brilliant researchers with many frustrations in their love lives. So they turned the scientific method to love, and they started something called the Love Lab, and they started longitudinal studies on couples that were multidimensional, that were looking not at just sort of interviews and questionnaires and scales of satisfaction, but they were also looking at the coding of nonverbal behaviors live and the recording of physiological measures. And then what they would do is have the couples come back to the lab every 4 years, over a number of years, and they would see what they found in terms of how these relationships were doing in terms of stability, but also in terms of relationship satisfaction. And they had initially five major studies that they had initiated. And those studies were looking at all different sorts of folks. They had newlywed couples. They had couples that were middle-aged, older couples. They had couples of all different socioeconomic backgrounds. And what they found was that there were four factors that they could use listening to a couple in conflict that would very reliably predict misery and breakup at about 93% accuracy. And then they found a number of factors that were predictive of relationships doing well over time. So they were really pointing at what they called masters in disasters. What are the characteristics of couples that do well over time, and what are the characteristics of couples that are, you know, really failing in relationship? And then from that, John and his wife, Dr. Julie Gottman, turned that research into a theory, and then into a workshop for couples, and then into a couples therapy method.
Now, Michael, would this just apply to people who've sort of already detected that their marriage is on the rocks? Are these techniques and things that really only apply once the masters of disaster have started down that path?
I think that they really tapped into some universal principles, first of all. So what they're really looking at, you know, in looking at couples that are doing well and then couples that are struggling, are some principles that really fit for all of us. You know, then, and I think that the, you know, one of the mottos of the Gottman Institute, which is the organization that they founded, is that we're all in this soup together. You know, that mm-hmm. They're not particularly relationship gurus, John and Julie Gottman. They would have the same struggles that any of us have. And so these principles, again, they're not just for distressed couples, they're for everybody.
All right. So they did some research, formed a theory, ultimately developed a workshop and some ways of helping people look at things differently. But let's start with the research. What were the kinds of things that they were finding that over time they were able to say with a reasonably high degree of accuracy that that these two people just aren't going to make it if they continue on this path?
Well, I think that's the right way of saying it is the if they continue on the path, because there is the belief that that we have the ability to make changes, but the most startling finding that they came up with was the discovery of what they called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, mm-hmm. and that was really teasing out four factors that if you saw those four factors emerging at a high frequency within a 10 to 15 minute sampling of a conflict discussion between a couple, that at about 92 to 93% accuracy, you could predict that in 5 years that couple would no longer be together.
Now, these four horsemen, I'm looking at a list here. It's criticism, defensiveness, stonewalling, and contempt. Take us through some examples. What would those look like? Would these like be obvious giant displays of contempt, or are these just like, would you notice just like a little eye roll at a certain moment? What are we talking about here?
It could be very subtle. So mm-hmm. so what they're talking about there would be as Dr. Paul Ekman has identified in his research on the expression of emotion through facial expression, mm-hmm. The rolling of eyes and the kind of the curling up the left side of the face, that over time the expression of contempt at that level, a nonverbal expression of contempt, could have the same effect as name calling, put down language, all of those sorts of things as well. So yeah, so contempt could show up in quite a subtle form, and seems to have the same deleterious effect on couples' relationships.
Now, I want to put a point on this because I'm reading here from an article you wrote in 2007 with a Marcia Gomez. It's titled Gottman, and mm-hmm. the sentence here is high expression of contempt in families has been found to be predictive of a significantly higher incidence of physical illness and premature death in all family members living in the home. That's a strong statement.
Strong statement. And this is an idea that was put forth by the Gottmans, but then also there were studies that really backed up that idea at Ohio State University. What they noted in the study at Ohio State, what they had done is they had taken small samples of blood looking for stress hormones, and then they observed couples in conflict and then observed their behaviors over time, and they monitored as well the physical health of those couples and family members. And what they noted is in the couples that had high conflict, there was a statistically much higher incident of illness in their children and in the recipient of the contempt. And that when they looked at, in Gottman's study, when they looked at contempt over time, and again, you know, these studies, the first studies go all the way back to 1971, as they follow those folks forward and they look at the high contempt couples, what they found is that there's a significant difference in lifespan when you look at the couples where there isn't contempt and then the couples where there is contempt. And I think what John Gottman would say is that if you live in a relationship with chronic contempt, you're probably losing about 5 years off your life.
Ouch. The mechanisms for those, I assume we're starting to understand them biochemically and how those would really translate.
You know, what they're theorizing about that is that the recipient of contempt, you know, is exposed to essentially an abusive environment, and that environment creates more stress hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, and that the chronic exposure to those stress hormones then inhibit immune function. And then having inhibited immune function over a long period of time, they are theorizing then would lead to more infectious disease and shorter lives.
All right, so let's turn to the method itself. Let's imagine a hypothetical couple. They have a desire to improve where they're at. That they're intrigued by this idea that maybe there's something to learn. Maybe there's new tricks. Maybe there's some tools they could gather. But they would want to improve their relationship. They have that. What would the Gottman method entail for this hypothetical couple?
Well, for a couple like that, you know, first of all, what I would recommend is not necessarily couples therapy, mm-hmm. but perhaps considering a couples workshop. Mm-hmm. The workshop that is sponsored, by the Gottman Institute. It's called The Art and Science of Love, which is a 2-day workshop, and then there's a follow up to that, which is another 2-day workshop. A couple could tap in on any number of webinars or DVD presentations or read the Gottman's most popular book, which would be Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work, through any of that kind of exposure. Or there's actually another workshop which is less experiential but just covers the material in that Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work book. What they would find in there is there would be a lot of material about friendship and building connection and specific tools on how to do that, tools also on how to manage conflict, and then tools on how to develop shared meaning in a relationship.
Interesting. So if somebody was, one of the pieces that I picked up from your writing was this idea of turning towards rather than turning away. Just to give people, when we say tools, I want to make this specific. So let's talk about that idea of turning towards versus turning away and how somebody might use that.
Okay. Well, if I can go back and talk about how they discovered that, it might be interesting.
Sure, absolutely. Context is great.
So the idea there is that at the University of Washington, as part of this laboratory that Gottman had set up, they created something called the Apartment Lab. And the apartment lab was essentially, I think John would say, a bed and breakfast, like any bed and breakfast, except you would have to give a blood and urine sample when you checked in and you checked out, and there was a camera in three corners of the room. And you would wear a halter monitor measuring seven different indices of your physiology, except when you were going to the bathroom or sleeping. So they would watch these couples for 24-hour periods and just see what they would do. And what they saw as they kind of laboriously looked over videotape of the couples is that inevitably one partner would make a bid to the other for something. You know, it could be conversation, affection, a back rub, you know, anything. And that the other partner, you know, in this somewhat naturalistic setting, would either turn towards that bid, and that would look like saying, you know, if it was a bid for conversation, it would be to engage in the conversation or at least mumble a couple of words. Or they would turn away, which would basically look like them ignoring their partner. Or they might just get ignored and they might turn against their partner and, you know, and say something harsh. And so what they found when they just measured that is that couples that turn towards at a high rate, like 86% of the time, those couples predictably did well. The couples that were these disaster couples tended to turn towards about 33% of the time. So they kind of looked at that and theorized about that. And so the theory basically says that each one of those incidents of turning towards is like a piece of emotional currency, if you will. And then we would imagine then that the couple has a kind of a shared emotional bank account, and that each one of those moments of turning toward is like a piece of currency that goes into that bank account, except that when there's a turning away or a turning against, we theorize there are five pieces of currency that come out. And that mm-hmm. comes from observing couples and seeing that, again, with these master couples, they will tend to have a rate of five positive behaviors to every one negative behavior, even in conflict. Where if you look at these couples that end up breaking up, they tend to have about, you know, 0.8 positive behaviors to every one negative behavior. And I'm saying positive and negative behaviors, meaning making critical comments or showing, you know, signs of contempt or other kind of nonverbal expressions, you know, that would be negative. So the idea there is that turning towards is sort of the mechanism of creating this emotional bank account, if you will, and that we can think about that bank account as being like a buffer against stress for a couple. So there's a resiliency factor for you right there on a couple's level. The idea would be if there tends to be a lot of turning towards and there's not much turning away, then the couple's, you know, got this healthy bank account. And then when they're facing the stresses of daily life, they tend to be able to ride through that. You know, like there's a shock absorber in the relationship.
So an example might be one of partner comes up and puts their hand on the other from behind or something, and then the receiving end of that, they can either turn towards and reciprocate that or acknowledge it in some way, or they can do nothing, or worse, they could turn away and actually break the contact and not reciprocate.
That would be a good example. And of course, it's more, you know, it's more complicated in the sense that, you know, going with that example, of course, individuals have all sorts of different tolerances around trust, and trauma mm-hmm. experiences can affect that, and, you know, certainly conflict in a relationship can affect that. So it oftentimes is not just a simple formula, but if they boil it down to its basic essence, it's the act of making some sort of bid. It could be like that, a nonverbal touch one, or it could be a verbal one. And then the response is either turning towards, turning away, or turning against. Yeah, that's sort of the mathematics of it.
Now, how would this particular example of turning towards, away, or against, how would that map into, say, other relationships in your life that are not your primary in this case?
Well, I mean, I think you can apply these same ideas to a work situation. You can apply it to a family situation. You can apply it to other kinds of social situations. That, you know, for example, working on a, you know, in a work situation, there are bids that we put out all the time to coworkers, you know, to join us on a project, to join us for lunch, to be part of something, you know, after hours or within hours, in a collaborative way, and how people respond to their coworkers. You could use the same kind of a way of thinking. You know, that there tends to be this sort of emotional bank account idea that goes on, and if there tends to be this turning away, if a team tends to turn away from other members, or members on a team tend to turn away from each other, that team is not going to have much cohesion, and there's not going to be much resiliency among that group.
You know, Michael, this is making me think that, you know, if life could be sort of viewed as improv theater, and the first rule of improv comedy is that no matter what the other partner does, you always respond with yes and, because as soon
That's
as
right.
you say no but, the joke dies and it's over. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, I knew that rule, but I hadn't put that one together. That's very apt.
Yeah. So it's that yes and really it does build it builds the connection and gives us a place to sort of keep moving and all of that. So I like this idea. There's a bank account, and you're either putting in or you're withdrawing from it. Michael, my question is about trust. And in my own life, I understand trust with another person in two ways. And you mentioned the word trust earlier, so I want to come back to that. It seems like a really important word in relationships. So in my life, I've discovered there are two ways I trust people. One, their repeated consistent actions tell me I can trust those actions. You know, somebody's always on time, I begin to trust on that basis. And a different type of trust is around knowing someone well enough to trust that I understand how they're going to react, even if I don't agree with that or necessarily approve of it or whatever. So those are the two types of trust I have in my life. And I'm interested in your expression and understanding of how trust works into a relationship. And in particular, what happens when it's been violated or in some way broken in a couple, knowing that, again, with this bank account idea, I've often heard that trust is like that same idea of a bank account. You're adding to it or you're withdrawing from it, but it's incremental on the way in, and it just floods out in the other direction.
Yeah, yeah, well said. You know, in terms of Gottman theory, trust and commitment are two elements that are later arrivals to the theory. And the reason for that is when they did the initial studies, they identified these kind of seven areas, or, you know, the seven principles that have to do with friendship, conflict management, and shared meaning. But John Gottman has written a book subsequent to the original studies called The Science of Trust. And he wrote that in part because he really said, you know, this theory is not, it's lacking something. This is not holding up the way it should. And so he looked at trust and looked at commitment, and sees that there's this process that goes on with couples in which a couple will meet. They may or may not fall in love, but typically there's some sort of process where in the beginning they have a strong emotional reaction to one another, but that eventually there's going to be a kind of a crisis of trust that will go on, if you will. And that would be really the asking of a question. If we're going to go forward, is this somebody that I can trust will have my back? And that when that question is answered, that then there's the possibility of moving on to the building of real commitment, which is that idea that this is a partner who's there for me, that really is like no other. Because the strongest predictor of betrayal in a relationship is when a partner starts to look around and make negative comparisons, you know, to look around at the neighborhood and say, geez, you know, my husband never goes out and plays with the kids, but look at Fred across the street, how he does that. Or, mm-hmm. or this other partner is so affectionate with my friend over here. But I don't get that. When we start to see those kind of comparisons, what is found in the research is that that is kind of the tipping point, if you will, potentially for a relationship to start to have betrayal. And I would say that in terms of betrayal in a relationship, it's a devastating thing. It's been written about a lot. Attachment theorists will just say it's a rupture to the relationship. It's a trauma to the relationship. And what we find is that there has to be a special kind of work that a couple does to recover from betrayal in a relationship, you know, especially if it's emotional betrayal, you know, sexual betrayal, but even financial betrayal. This is a big blow to a relationship.
All right. Well, what would couples need to do if they had experienced some form of betrayal? And again, there's a spectrum of betrayals. This doesn't necessarily mean the big one, you know, affairs or something like that. But they right. can be small or increasing in size on this spectrum. Somebody might be completely faithful in one area, but being sort of betraying routinely in others. You know, not backing your partner up in public, or you know, throwing your spouse under the bus as a parent in conversation with kids, whatever happens, right? How would you go about beginning to address that in a therapeutic sense?
Well, if we just looked at the smaller bits of betrayal, like not standing up for you, you know, with your mom, or with my mom, mm-hmm. maybe that's even more to the point, with my mom, and having you feel like you were, you know, left out in the cold. What we would say is couples need to get really good at having an aftermath discussion. And that aftermath discussion really needs to involve being able to talk about the underlying emotions that were present during this event, and to listen well, and to show understanding, to say validating things to one another about how they felt during this incident. And then especially, although, you know, in many interactions, they'd say, well, it takes two to tango, but especially in a betrayal incident where one party clearly has stepped out of bounds with the other, the important thing then is to get into a kind of what we call an admitting mode, and to take responsibility for one's actions, to atone for one's actions, make apologies, and then to come to some sort of plan how to do it differently. And I guess I would add with the bigger betrayals, I would say all those things that I just said are true, but would say that I say with a sexual or emotional affair, where there's been secrecy involved, the important thing there is for the partner that stepped out on this relationship, that has betrayed the relationship, absolutely important for that partner to atone for actions by admitting one's actions and by being willing to answer any of the questions that their partner has, because what we tend to see is there is this trauma response when there's been betrayal in a relationship. The person who has been betrayed oftentimes will have all the symptoms of PTSD. You know, we'll have hypervigilance, we'll have ruminative thoughts, we'll be avoiding certain kinds of interactions or situations that may trigger, those same feelings. So there has to be this answering of questions so that a person doesn't jump to all kinds of conclusions in one's mind. And this is a very rigorous process to go through, very demanding process. And then a couple would need to learn to reattune to one another, to create really a new kind of relationship with a more solid foundation, and be able to listen to each other, and the good and the bad. So to be able to learn to tolerate difficult conversations with one another and really listen, and then to figure out how can we do something different in the future not to get back in that situation again. You know, what would be the ways that we would do that to have a better, you know, like cell wall around this relationship to keep that kind of boundary?
Yeah. Michael, I'm sort of keying in on this particular aspect of this word betrayal because it's shown up a lot recently in how people are talking to me about their experience of this current administration or, you know, the healthcare bill or whatever it is. People are starting to feel betrayed even generationally, where millennials are going, yeah. Hey, you know, who ate my cheese, right? You know,
right.
Thanks, yeah. Boomers. Nice debt pile and crumbling infrastructure. That's awesome. You know, so there's that sense of betrayal. What I wanted to surface in this is what you did beautifully is that it's really impactful, and you can't just sort of swallow it and forget it and move on and hope for the best. It's going to kind of sit there until it has some way of being processed.
Exactly. I hadn't thought of it in that same way in a larger context, but I believe that the same principles apply. And I think that, you know, at the more microscopic level with a couple, what you oftentimes see is the partner who has, again, broken trust with their, you know, with their intimate partner and may have the feeling, understandably, can't we just move on? Can't you just get over this? You know, I've been tortured already. I've said 1,000 apologies. Mm-hmm. Can't we just forget about this? But the truth is that it doesn't go that way. There needs to be accountability. There needs to be the honest answering of questions, because otherwise, our minds are such that we can think of all kinds of horrible possibilities that are probably worse than reality. Unless we get honest answers and forthright answers that we can buy into, we will continue to think about all sorts of things. And so, that I think that's how trust is rebuilt.
Right, exactly. And one of the reasons I keep bringing up the macro versus the micro is that as a parent, it took me a while to catch on to this, but I started to realize that as my kids were going through certain developmental stages, it was like I was reliving my own at the age the kid was, right? So if something happened to me when I was three and my kid's three, and I'm not aware of what's happening, all of a sudden, you know, what it took me a while to figure out, Michael, that I was re-experiencing my own childhood wounding and traumas and other things as my kids went through the stage. So I raise this as if there are macro betrayals going on, I think it's only logical to understand that that might be scratching at your own scab, your own wound of betrayal that's sitting there unacknowledged in your relationship. I just find these times where the world is sort of on fire, as it were, that is often a catalyst for reexamination and surfacing of things within relationships. It can happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I would say that's absolutely right.
So we talked about one specific type of rupture with betrayal, but let's say a couple they've done the workshop, they've done the books, but they look like they're looking for they're at a kind of a precarious stage. They want maybe more of an intervention. What do they go through?
Okay, in that case, I would say the thing that really differentiates a workshop from couples therapy is that we start off with a very rigorous assessment. You know, when couples come to a workshop, mm-hmm. what we're doing in that case is a kind of just a very simple questionnaire to make sure that this would be a good experience, that this wouldn't put people under undue stress or create any kind of safety problems. Mm-hmm. But we're not doing any kind of assessment at all. And so this is, you know, a workshop is really not therapy.
Right.
Therapy entails an assessment that takes at least 3 1.5-hour sessions the way we do it. It starts out with an hour and a half with the couple together. We have certain protocols we go through in terms of talking about the concerns that the couple is bringing in to discuss. We have the couple do the same thing that was done in the Love Lab, where we say, you know, please talk about an area of conflict, you know, preferably the one that brings you in, but it really could be any area of conflict between the two of you. And while a couple does that, we ask that they wear pulse oximeters because we want to have an idea what goes on with them physiologically. And oftentimes we videotape because we want to look at nonverbal behaviors as well. And that's about, you know, 10 or 15 minutes that we may do that. And then we take a very thorough history of the couple's relationship in between the first session and the next time we see the couple. We either have them go online to a secure website and complete a packet of questionnaires, or we actually hand them a physical packet, depending on what they're comfortable with. And then we score that packet and come back to the next set of meetings, which is either two separate individual meetings or another hour and a half that we divide into two portions, one for one partner and one for the other partner. And we use a lot of what we learned in the first meeting and in that questionnaire packet to ask more questions individually of this partner, to learn about this partner and their personal history as much as we can, and their view about relationship, you know, any comorbidities, meaning issues with violence, issues with trauma, with other mental health issues, with substance abuse. So we want to get as much information as we can about the individual. And then in the third session, we put all that together using the sound relationship house theory, which is the theory that comes from Gottman's research. We use that as a template to give feedback to the couple in reference to the areas in which they're complaining about, and then to shed light on what they may do to have improvement. And we give specific suggestions about what they can do in the therapy and outside of the therapy, and are there any additional services that may be helpful to them that would help them move towards goals that we would establish along with them that would be in line with, again, the sound relationship house theory, but also these kind of presenting complaints they have, you know, things like being emotionally disconnected in the relationship, or having conflict that escalates, or not being able to talk about conflict and being, you know, in gridlock around that, or having a betrayal of trust, or having question about commitment in a relationship, or having a lack of shared meaning. You know, oftentimes happens in, you know, just in the normal cycle of the family, that that we launch the kids and we go into retirement, or one person's working less, and we don't know where we're going anymore as a couple, you know, and there needs to be a rebuilding of shared meaning. So we focus on whichever areas are important, and we, you know, see if the couple is willing to continue to work in therapy on that.
And I assume, you know, you started this in 2002, that's 15 years ago with this method. And I assume you've stuck with it because it's effective.
I believe it's effective. I see in my own experience in the practice, I see it's effective. My colleague that went through the training with me, you know, works in the same practice, and she sees very much the same thing. What I would say is that the Gottman Institute and the profession as a whole, or group of professions, helping professions as a whole, need to do more outcome-oriented studies. We can, you know, there's some of this that's been done, but there needs to be more. You know, the outcome research on couples has been done with couples that are kind of, if you will, worried well couples. And we can see with, you know, traditional methods of couples therapy, they go from being kind of, you know, if you will, worried well couples to couples that are reasonably happy. And in clinical practice, we tend to see very, very distressed couples. Mm-hmm. And we need to see more measures that look at the kind of work that we do to see how are we doing with those couples. There's some research. There needs to be more.
Okay. Now, I'm interested in this idea that there's a whole resentment industry that's built up around couples breaking apart, with, you know, 50% of marriages ending in divorce. And there's a legal profession that just feasts on that whole process. You know, understanding that sometimes this may fail and people may end up separating with that sort of sense of blame and resentment. Is there not also, and if this is a tricky question, you know, please tell me, but what about the idea that sometimes that people are attracted to each other initially based on early childhood wounds or family patterns and things like that, but that once they work through those issues, they find that the spark of attraction that really drew them initially is no longer there? That is, can people just outgrow each other, but in a good way, in part not with blame and resentment, but just say, oh, well, that part of our life kind of seems to have worked itself through?
It could be that that's the, it's interesting. I think that, you know, it that could be the case. The thing I think that we see primarily with couples is that couples will tend to come together not because of similarities, but because of differences. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I guess to say this, tangibly, it could be that there's a person that tends to be introverted and they pick a partner that they see as quite vibrant. And they'll say, boy, this person really lights me up. But mm-hmm. then what they find over time is that that very characteristic that was the thing that attracted them is now something they have a hard time dealing with. Mm. And that now I'm this introverted person and my partner wants to have the whole church group over. And that's like way too much for me. I can't handle that. And so I'm wanting to go hide in the other room. And so you'll see that kind of thing happening oftentimes in couples, and that is in this research what Gottman identified as perpetual problems. He would say 69% of the problems that any couple faces are ones that they could never solve, and they're ones that will always be with you. For example, one person's introverted, one person's extroverted. One person likes to talk about their feelings, and the other one says, I'm really more of a cognitive person, and that I get overwhelmed when you show so much emotion. Or one person wants to spend a lot of time together, and the other one says that's too much for me. Those tend to be personality styles that don't change much over time. Yet we see 69% of the problems in couples that are successful, as well as 69% of the problems in couples that are not successful. So we know this is something that this is just personality differences, and that's not predictive of a couple falling apart or not. The thing that seems to be the solution, if you will, to the unsolvable problem issue is that it's those couples that can learn acceptance and that could learn how to be in dialogue with one another do well over time. And those couples that are not able to talk about it, that there are these problems that get so big that they get into what we call a kind of a gridlock, where they just say, let's not talk about it. It's too painful. And couples will tend to drift apart from one another. So we tend to see that in large numbers. I would say that's a big swath. But in terms of, I guess, back to your original question of changes that can happen, I think that certainly couples can outgrow each other, and especially if they're not in dialogue about, they're not keeping up with one another, they're losing track of one another. That certainly can be the case.
Well, it's interesting, this idea of perpetual problems, as you describe them. In our language at Peak Prosperity, we differentiate between problems and predicaments. Problems have solutions, predicaments have outcomes. If you spend your time trying to seek a solution to a predicament, you're wasting your time. It just has something you have to manage as intelligently as you can, but you can't shift its course on the macro scale. It's like demographics. That's not a problem. It's just a thing. It's a predicament, right? So if you suddenly have a lot of aging people in a society, unless you're willing to do something really, unthinkably draconian, it's a predicament. And so you have to manage towards that and figure that out. So it sounds like there's a similar thing. If you can begin to parse through your relationship and say, these are the things that we can work on, but these are just things we're going to have to negotiate around or navigate around. They're like rocks in the river. They exist.
We would say that the conflict needs to be managed, that the idea that you're going to go, say, to see this great therapist and you'll be able to resolve all your main problems, we would say that's a fallacy. That if what you can learn instead in the management of that conflict is how to be in dialogue with these areas where you're perpetually different, that's as good as it gets. So I could say, that it falls in with the kind of that idea of a predicament. That is, it's a predicament of your relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. That makes a lot of sense. And we're out of time. I could just keep talking with you forever. Mike, first, thank you so much for your time today. But second, you practice out of Santa Rosa. I'm wondering, how can people find out more about the Gottman Method generally and find yourself or another qualified practitioner if this has sparked that interest in them?
You bet. The website, www.gottman.com, is the central hub for all of this. And there's a drop down on the menu that says help for couples. Within that, there's information about couples workshops, the ones that the Gottmans do in Seattle, as well as the ones that the rest of us do all around the country, which have the same curriculum. There's also part of that menu that says find a therapist. And I'm on there. My colleague Marcia Gomez is on there. And many, many other therapists. It would show you all the therapists within, you know, what your geographic area. You can set parameters so you can do that kind of search. And it will show you if someone is certified in the method, such as myself, or if they've taken up to level 2 training. There's a 3-step process of trainings, and then beyond that, there's a certification track that involves all kinds of rigorous stuff they make us go through in order to get certified. So you can see the level of training, and you can see who's in your area off that website.
Well, that's www.gottman.com. And we've been talking with Michael Basta. Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. Enjoyed it.